slowly rolling into it and off of corner number four. It's showtime at Skagit Speedway. Trey Starks looking for Skagit Speedway history. First driver to win Dirt Cup in the 360 Nationals in the same year. Looking to become the second driver to be our 410 and 360 champion in the same year. Joining only Randy Ridge from 25 years ago. History again for Trey Starks. It's showtime!
One car with the front of it that was junk, and another car with the back of it was junk. So I cut both of them in half, took the good part of one car and the good part of the other car, and welded up the
reason why I decided to move to Sean's number and use it was just because in memory of Sean was his V8. And, I just kind of lived for racing and racing with his number just to remember him by.
Racing, and next thing you know, she's on the flag stand running the, doing flag and all my quarterback. I'm like, where did you come from?
You definitely have to want it. You can't just say you want it. You got to want it. You got to have that desire that drives you.
I hope they just, soak it all in, because you don't know when it could be over, right? Mom and Dad can't do this anymore, right? We don't have the money, or we can't find the sponsors, whatever it is. I just soak it all up while it's happening.
That was at Elma. This is a different track. I don't think it'll be the same thing. He's like, oh, okay, you can throw it on. We threw the GoPro on his car, and he actually did pretty good, that okay. I believe. So we're like, see? Convinced him. I was like, see, it's only at Elma. You can't rent a GoPro. And then the next week, I believe he blew up a motor with the GoPro on, so I haven't put a GoPro on his car since then.
Well, welcome into episode 18 of On the Gas, a Skagit Speedway podcast. Blake Anderson, Eric List, and this week we're joined by Trey Starks. Trey, thanks for coming on again. We had you on as the first episode, and now it's the end of the year. Trophy Cups happen. We wanted to bring you on and talk about Trophy Cup and just kind of dive deeper into your career as well. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's hard to believe the first time we had you on was a week after one of the biggest wins of your career at Dirt Cup, and now you had a heck of a year. I mean, you continued to add on that. You picked up a couple of track championships. I feel like you guys are just clicking along as good as you ever have. Do you feel that way, Trey?
Yeah, I definitely feel that way. We had a banner year. I mean, if we never, in terms of, racing at Skagit Speedway and racing locally, if we never had a year as big as we did this year, I honestly wouldn't be surprised and also wouldn't really be disappointed. I mean, obviously you're always, shooting to have, win as many races as you can. But I guess in terms of this year is going to be really hard to beat. I mean, 2025 is going to be a tough one to beat. Mainly because I think the competition level at Skagit is getting so good. Every year it's gotten better and better. And so to kind of, not necessarily steal all of these accomplishments away, or get away with them, I guess is what I said, because I do feel like, we put in the work to be where we are. But it's going to be tougher and tougher every year to do something like we did this year. So, to be able to accomplish all of that in one year, right now, while the competition is rising and getting tougher, makes me feel really proud. But yeah, I would not be surprised if we're not able to duplicate it. Now, that being said, we're going to try and not only duplicate it, but do better and better and better every year, as tough as that may be.
You're someone that's seen Skagit, from now to way back when. Is it kind of exciting to see the talent continuing to rise again and growing in the 410 class and in the 360 as well?
Yeah, so my first ever sprint car race was, believe it or not, a 410 race at Skagit in 2010. I was 13 or 14 years old, I believe, at the time. And so I have seen many, many different versions and iterations of Skagit Speedway over the years. We raced a lot there in my early years, and then we did some traveling with our car, and then I went and drove for different car owners, back east and through the Midwest for a few years, and then kind of came back and ran it regularly. We ran on and off during that time. I think I only think I missed maybe one Dirt Cup or so in there. We would always find a gap in the schedule to try and come back and at least hit Dirt Cup or you know, one of the races back home. Yeah, from 2010 until basically now, I think we came back and I started running back home for our team in, I want to say, 2020. 2019, I think, was my last. 2019 or 2020 was my last year on the road. So from when it started, and because back then we still had the 410 program. Mm-hmm. There were still 410s. The 360 program was really good. And then kind of around the time I left was when 410s went away. And so we saw a different version of Dirt Cup, which was, you know, they had great success with the 360s there for a while. And then to come back and see 410s kind of be revived, the competition level has changed a ton. But the constant increase, not only in the 410 class, but also in the 360s, but mainly focusing on 410s because that's the class that's being brought back. It has steadily increased every year. Every year I kind of tell myself, you know, we've added, you know, three or four more cars. It seems like there's no way that we can, where are we going to find these cars? Where do these cars come from? And every year, you know, we have more teams that either, you know, more competitors, or we have more teams, you know, stepping up. You see 360, you know, jump to 410 or Sportsman jump to 360 or a little bit of both. So for me, it's been really, really cool to see, you know, from that kind of transition from not only from the start when I started racing in 2010, but also from kind of the revamp with Kevin Rudine and John Hager and 26 Promotions and everybody involved at Skagit, just kind of revitalizing the entire racing program. It's been really rewarding for me, for sure.
You mentioned going back east. How did the relationship come together to you for you to run with Scott Gobrecht and Jeff McCall? Scott being a PA guy and the Gobrecht name, obviously, really, really tied to 410 sprint car racing on the East Coast, and Jeff McCall out of North Carolina. How did that relationship develop and come together for you to move across the country and race sprint cars in central Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it came together. It was mainly, I think I would attribute it to, we started running J&J cars with Jack and Bonnie. I bought my first two cars, and you've all heard this story about the original two cars. Those two cars we purchased in 2013. I met Jack and Bonnie when I was back at Williams Grove at the National Open with our car, with the 55. And we were kind of at a point where we didn't really have a brand that we were loyal to. We, you know, we tried a few different cars and we were looking for something to switch to. And Jack and Bonnie, we hooked up with them. And so I started running their cars. And Jack and Bonnie had a really good relationship with Jeff McCall out of North Carolina. He had run their cars for a long time and had a really good relationship. You know, we traveled a little bit with our stuff, but we knew it wasn't realistic for us to be on the road a bunch with our family team. So around that time, I was kind of looking for an opportunity. So I would talk with Jack probably once a week, and we would just have general conversation about racing and things that are going on. And, you know, usually at the end of the conversation, I would say, you know, Jack, if you know of any opportunities to drive something, keep me in mind, let me know. And probably about, I don't know, 6 to 8 months or maybe even a year goes by, and he calls me one day and he says, I have this car owner out of North Carolina. He doesn't race very much, but he has plenty of equipment and really good equipment. He would, you know, he'd like to go racing. He can't do it all the time, but, you know, he'd like to put something together towards the end of the year. I believe that was 2015, to run, world finals. Our first race was supposed to be the National Open, but that year, it didn't actually rain out, but it rained so much that us and everybody else assumed it was going to rain out. So yep. We actually scrapped that. And we ended up running a couple 360 races in the Carolinas and I think in Florida. We won one of our first races right out of the gate. I knew it was going to be a pretty good relationship. And then, they were 360 races. They were USCS. So, the competition was a little bit lower than if you were to go to an outlaw race. But we had speed nevertheless. And we kind of confirmed that when that year we took his car to the world finals at Charlotte. And, on one of the prelim nights, we were really fast. We arguably could have won our prelim night, but we ended up having the track was pretty fast, and we ended up having a component in the front end break, so we weren't able to finish. So we broke leading. So that was kind of a heartbreak, but it was really cool how much speed we had right out of the gate. I raced with Jeff McCall in the 23. It was a 23 at that point for a year or two. And then we connected. Jeff had a good relationship with Scott Gobrek for a long time, leading back to, I believe it was his time with, I believe it was the 93 team was owned by Dave Blaney. And I want to, was it a part ownership with
Hilton?
With Woodruff?
I think Woodruff worked on it for a little bit. They had a lot of guys go through there. When Scott's brother passed.
I don't know how or when Jeff McCall's relationship with Dave Blaney started, but Dave was one of Jeff's closest friends. Mm-hmm. And so I know with Kevin driving that 93, the Amoco car, they had a relationship since the early 2000s, late 90s. And so we actually went up to and ran Pennsylvania a couple times in Jeff's car. And Scott had a car that Chase Dietz was driving at the time. And over the off season of, I believe, 2016, Scott and Chase split up. And so Jeff and Scott and I started having conversations about a partnership that would allow us to be somewhat based out of Pennsylvania, because with me traveling from Washington to Pennsylvania and then Jeff towing his car from North Carolina up to Pennsylvania, it was, if we wanted to race in Central PA more, we knew, it would be nicer to be based out of Central PA. So we worked out a deal and got connected with Scott and set up shop right there in New Oxford, Pennsylvania. And we kind of had it was a two-location team technically, but I would say we spent 75% of our time in New Oxford and 25% in Cherryville, North Carolina, which is where Jeff's shop was. If we ran in Pennsylvania, we would obviously run out of Scott's shop. If we took off and ran, somewhere in the Midwest or Eldora or Knoxville, we would usually run everything out of Jeff's shop. So it was kind of a unique situation, and it's tough to make those kinds of things work. I always say any sort of partnership in sprint car racing that involves more than just the driver and an owner gets really complicated, because even those kinds of relationships can get complicated really fast. So for us to, make it work for however many years, 3 or 4 years with, basically two owners, a driver and countless sponsorship partners too, I was really happy for how we made that work. Yeah, we ran in Central PA for a couple of years, had some success, won some races, got my first All-Star win in Bedford, which that was really cool. That was kind of a breakthrough for me, because, we beat the – I had never won in Central Pennsylvania, and I had definitely never won with the All-Stars. And so kind of to beat the Posse and the All-Stars in one night was pretty special to me, especially a place like Bedford where it's so unique. We actually – I knew the night was going to be pretty good because we went out and we set the track record in qualifying. And it was something about the track that I kind of, myself and the car, we just kind of all meshed really well. And, that time and every other time we went to Bedford, we were always really fast. I'm pretty sure I still have the track record there because we ended up, we broke it in 17 and then we went back for an All-Star race in 2018 and we broke it again. We didn't end up winning that night. I think we broke racing with Brian Brown.
Won that night.
Yeah. Brown was also there in Thielen's Grove. He was always really fast. So
yeah, big tracks.
Yeah, to be on par with him, especially in that time, was really cool. So to get that breakthrough win at Bedford, and then we won the Mitch Smith Memorial, which was a a Speed Week show.
That's 10 grand to win?
Yeah, yep, 10 grand to win. That was a really special one. Williams Grove, I mean, we've won two or three times there, and I'll tell you, well, I'm not alone here, that I still have not figured that place out. I don't know if there are very people that have. You know, just that, and just like every track in Pennsylvania, they're unique. I think they intrigue me because they're mostly really big and really fast, and that's just not necessarily something that we get a lot of out here on the West Coast. So, you know, something a little different really excited me. And just the excitement behind racing. I've always said it's really easy to get excited about sprint car racing in Central Pennsylvania because everybody else is excited about sprint car racing in Central Pennsylvania. So, yeah, it was a really cool experience for me. And then kind of to end our relationship there, we spent the last couple years in, I would say, you know, year and a half in Knoxville. Things were getting busier here with me and with work, and I kind of was upfront with them that, you know, I can't be traveling as much if I want to pay as much attention here at work. And so I was pretty much set on, you know, having to be done, having to kind of end the relationship, or just kind of pause semi-full-time national racing at that time to come back and pay attention at work. And they said, you know, I'm really grateful for the opportunity they gave me, because they gave me the option to basically be based out of Knoxville, Iowa, and fly in and out every week. I would fly in every Friday. We'd race on Saturday, and then I'd fly out Sunday. And so yeah, I basically, you know, could work still full time and still race full time. So I was really, really grateful that they were able to do that for me. You know, we did it for a year or two. And then as things got busier here, I, you know, ended up having to come home full time. But you know, that whole relationship it opened a lot of doors in my career, I think. You know, it gave me a lot of experience. It gave me some wins in Central Pennsylvania. Both my all-star wins. We got another one at the night before the 50, you know, a month after we were able to go and win our prelim night at Knoxville. You know, I have a lot of highlights, I feel like, or a lot of breakthrough moments in those years. And, you know, the all-star win at Bedford being one, the Mitch Smith at Williams Grove. We started on the pole of the King's Royal one year. And then the Knoxville prelim night, I mean, that's still one of the most memorable nights in my career. I mean, the feeling of winning those is unlike anything else. And, you know, if it wasn't for them allowing me to come and run locally there and get the laps that I needed to get better at a track like Knoxville, you know, that wouldn't be possible. So, but yeah, no, we finished out our relationship together running Knoxville weekly. And, you know, racing for Scott and Jeff were some of the, you know, greatest moments that I can remember in my career for sure. Unfortunately, we lost Jeff about a year ago now. And he was a great guy, he made a huge impact, you know, to the sport, I think, in his involvement. And he's been involved in like every form of motorsports I can imagine. I mean, he, in sprint car racing, he's been here, there, and everywhere. He, you know, crewed for Dave Blaney when he raced. I think he was an official with the USCS there for a while. Mm-hmm. He told me even at one point he either managed or had some sort of big part in a monster truck team. I mean, he's been here there. When Blaney had his, I think it was, what, the Dave Blaney driving experience?
Yep.
Yeah, Jeff, I think, took care of a lot of that. Yeah, he managed it. He had a big part in it. Just a guy that loved racing. You know what I mean? He has been around it all his life. It's all he ever knew. You know, he was never one to follow the crowd, and I think that's a lot of, you know, Dave Blaney rubbing off on him. everybody's seen a picture of Dave's latest creation that was obviously very successful at Sharon. I mean, we would roll in. We never rolled in with anything standard. our car was always goofy. From what we were doing with the car to the paint scheme, I think everybody remembers that year. Everything was a little off the wall. I always tell people that you know, the neon colors and bright brightness on the car was probably just smoke and mirrors for whatever, you know, experiment Jeff had cooked up with that thing. So it always kept it really interesting. We were really fast at times, and sometimes, you know, we struggled a little bit given what we had going on with the car. But Jeff was the type of guy that if we were to, you know, order a standard car out of a catalog and bolt everything together, I mean, he didn't want to go racing if we were going to go race that way. If he couldn't do it his way, he wasn't interested. So, and I'm really a lot, I'm that way a lot too. I'm a big interest in racing for me is how these cars work and, you know, doing something different than the next guy and finding a little bit here, a little bit there. So, you know, we lost a good one in the sport. I'll never forget my years racing for Scott and Jeff. I was able to see Scott when we went and ran Port Royal here last month, so that was really special for me. Scott's also very, very involved in racing, from owning cars to, you know, he's part owner in two racetracks now. He's got Baps and Lincoln out there in Central Pennsylvania. So two guys that have given a whole heck of a lot to the sport, and I'm happy that I was just able to be a part of, you know, an involvement with both of them. So if it wasn't for them, we definitely wouldn't be where we are today.
When you lived in New Oxford, how much did you eat at Substop?
Every single day.
What is Substop?
It's a good little restaurant. There's Brian Lepo's sister that owns it, I believe.
Yep. The Lepos, they brought Substop to Port Royal every day because Lawton Lepo works on 14 cars. So that was a really cool full circle moment for me.
Oh, that's great. That was always a must stop when we ran Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. We were about 3 minutes from, you know, it was just right down the road from our shop. And, I have very, very many fond memories from living in Central Pennsylvania. I always tell my wife I have a specific memory of driving through Hanover in my little Honda Accord that I had back there and kind of sensing that, you know, everything back home was, you know, starting to speed up. And I told her, I have a specific memory that, you know, this will basically be the last moment in my life driving down there, you know, racing sprint cars full time, that I will basically have, you know, not a whole lot of responsibility. So I remember thinking, if you soak this up, this is, you know, this is basically your last chance. So enjoy it. Because the real world's gonna, hit you like a ton of bricks here. So, and that was true. I mean, it was, you know, I enjoyed every moment that I could racing full time, basically back there during the summers, because, you know, it doesn't last forever. The one, as tough as it is running up and down the road driving sprint cars, you know, it's a luxury.
Yeah.
And it's few and far between, you know, not for the faint of heart, and it's not easy. So I'm glad I was able to enjoy my little bit of time of, you know, being a hired driver. And
I feel like one of the synonymous things with your car here is the TNC Concepts 55, Trey and Colin. What is TNC Concepts, though? I mean, like, I don't know much about it. I know I see it on your race car all the time. I believe you're partially in aerospace, but you talk about kind of transitioning from racing to more working and stuff along that lines. When did TNC Concepts kind of come into play?
Yeah, so TNC Concepts, I want to say TNC Concepts was created in probably 2005 or 6, and it sat idle for 10 plus years, mainly because nobody really knew what it was going to be yet. My dad was a third generation logger. Stark's family's rooted deeply in the timber industry. I remember growing up just like, you know, any decent parent, they always obviously want something better for their kids. Right. So, I would go out to, you know, we're based in Puyallup. Most of the job sites were, over in the Shelton, really actually Grays Harbor area. Ironically with the racetrack being there, that's where a lot of his work was. So he had, you know, 2+ hour commutes to and from work. I mean, long hours, logging is tough work. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of loggers in the Skagit area. Everybody kind of knows what I'm talking about. And I always remember being, you know, going to work with my dad when I was younger and being, you know, really intrigued with the equipment and kind of everything going on. And my dad was very adamant about, you know, you do not want to be in this industry. You don't want this, you know, you need to go to school and, you know, have an easier life. He's like, you know, this is really hard work. It's, you know, not a whole lot of fun all the time. The one thing I think that kept my dad going is, you know, he obviously raced as well. But he just loved operating, you know, a machine, equipment, anything like that. So, you know, he didn't operate as much, you know, obviously when he owned the company, he had employees, but, you know, he would love to go out there on a weekend when nobody else was working and just process wood with the machine. He always said that, you know, this is, I don't want this for you kids. I want you guys to find something that you really enjoy doing. And that, you know, you're not driving, you know, 2 hours to and from work, you know, 18 hour days in wet, cold. I mean, it's not a glamorous lifestyle, you know, being a logger. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. So, we always kind of discussed what we wanted to do. You know, it was always kind of a discussion. Well, what do we like to do? What do we think we could make money at? With, you know, between my dad and my grandpa and my uncle Dean, my uncle Dean's a very, very good fabricator. He's worked for various vintage race teams, road race teams. He worked for a large Porsche race team in Florida for a long time. So he's got a big fabrication background, mainly from the racing, with my dad and my grandpa racing. So we actually, my dad and Uncle Bean built every quarter midget that we ever ran, built it from scratch, from the raw tubing. We built everything right here in the shop that DNC currently operates out of. And so that was kind of our thing. It's like, well, we like fabricating, we like making things. Let's maybe think about buying some machines and some equipment to, you know, be better apt to fabricate machines, just make parts, you know, make things. And so we started to transition a little bit out of the logging. We kind of downsized. Stark Timber Processing downsized a little bit there in about 2014, 2015. He got to a point where he was bigger than he wanted to be. He had more employees than he wanted to manage. And so we downsized. He sold some equipment off. We had a little bit of money to reinvest. So we bought a CNC mill and a CNC water jet. And at first it was, you know, here's some equipment. We can make things. We've got some ideas. We didn't really have any specific, like, we didn't buy this equipment because we knew somebody had a need for this specific part. We bought the equipment and said, let's, you know, grow into it organically. And let's learn how to use it. Let's, you know, my brother was in high school at this time and I was just getting into college. So, I went to college to get an engineering degree, learn how to, you know, design and things like that. And it started off that way. Just let's take it slow. Let's see where it goes. Let's take the time to learn the stuff. And then probably sometime there in 2015 or 16, I kind of remember it vividly. We were working in the shop on something and my dad kind of comes in the door and says something along the lines of, I just sold off all my equipment. I just fired every employee I have. We're done logging. So, we have to figure out how to make this make money. So it went from, we're going to learn slow, we're going to figure it out, to this has got to make money within a year, basically.
Wow.
We took we sold off the logging equipment. We replaced it with a few more. At this point, I was racing back east. I was going to college full time at Western, which was a juggling act to begin with. and I kind of said, you know, to myself and to my family, it was, you know, I got three things going on. We've got racing, college, and now I have basically work full time. Fortunately, something's got to go, and it ended up cool. I dropped out of college you know, within a couple weeks. And because I knew I didn't want to quit racing, I knew that I could always go back to college in theory, right? The racing opportunities don't always present themselves, and work was very demanding. So since then, we've added, with the CNC mill and the water jet, we've added three more five-axis CNC mills and a CNC lathe. And so now we have technically six CNC machines. We do anything from prototype to semi-production to full-on production for various aerospace companies. It's mainly CNC machining. There's a lot of demand for prototype and production manufacturing in this area because of mainly from Boeing. But we really don't do a whole lot of Boeing work. Our bulk is in just general aerospace, which falls under really Amazon, Blue Origin, SpaceX, and various other rocket or satellite, or really you name it. There's a ton of, you know, even tech. We do some manufacturing for a company here local that makes components for the quantum computing power that basically powers AI right now. So there's tons of demand. It's just it's willingness to kind of change with the industry. I feel like us being basically, I mean, we have background in fabrication, right, just generally, but as far as machining and programming these machines and design and the CAD and the CAM and everything that goes with it, myself nor my brother Colin have any actual schooling or training on it. We had to, because everything happened so fast, we had to teach ourselves how to do everything. So I handle basically all of the programming in the front end of the business, and Colin manages the shop floor, so he manages all the manufacturing operations, basically runs all the machines. And he was trained for about 2 weeks, very loosely, by someone that we knew here local that managed a pretty big Boeing supply shop. He was a shop foreman, so he kind of taught Colin the ins and outs of how to, you know, how to run everything on the machines, from, you know, setting tools to editing programs to anything in between. And then myself with the programming, I 100% taught myself. There's a lot of, you know, pretty good literature online and some good videos you can watch. And really just the best training, I think, was just by doing. We wouldn't have learned as fast as we did if we didn't basically have to. You know, with my dad coming out one day and saying, you know, everything on the logging side is done. I'm tired of it. I'm over it. It's gone. Let's make this work. I don't think he could have learned. I don't think any sort of schooling could have taught us, you know, as quickly as we had to learn by ourselves. So, yeah, it's thankfully kind of blossomed into for my dad, he's in heaven. He went from, you know, 20 employees, basically, you know, for lack of better words, you know, running his equipment up and down the road and tearing it up and just having to manage all of that. He had several sides of work going on, so he'd have job sites, you know, not only 2 hours from home, but, you know, hours apart from each other that he'd have to make. And so he went from that to the shops right here at our complex is my parents' house, my house, and they're all in the same area. So yeah, he went from a huge team to manage to him and my brother basically in the shop, and he can walk out his front door and be at work in a couple minutes. Really, for us to be able to kind of build this into think not only ourselves and our families, but also support, you know, our race, want to do it and are able to do it here. Kind of just a perfect pairing what we have going on with our work, having, you know, scattered more or less, I wouldn't say in our backyard, you know, it's 2 hours away, but it's a lot closer than anything else in California. And honestly, it pays better, and they have a better program than anything else in the area. Honestly, they're one of the best programs in the entire United States. So we are very, very lucky to have, you know, that here. What they're doing, we wouldn't race as much today. You know, having a business like this with only, you know, a couple employees, basically just us, you know, it's a ton of work. We spend a ton of hours here, and we wouldn't be able to really get away for any longer than, you know, a day or two a week at Gadget. So, yeah, it's grown into a really good thing for not only us and our families, like I said, but to allow us to be able to race and support Skagit. You know, it's crazy in life the way things fall, but, you know, I think everything felt just perfectly for us to be in the position, you know, circling back to you know, have the seasons that we've had over the last couple of years.
Wow, I didn't even know half that with TNC. That's fascinating. That's really fascinating, impressive. You cut out, you cut out a couple times there, so I just want to recap and see if I heard. It's you, Colin, your brother, and your dad. Do you have any more employees really than that?
Those are the main three on the basically day to day operations.
Okay.
My mom works, you know, does some accounting, you know, a couple days a week, and then we just recently brought my wife on. And we're kind of training her to do various things, custodial, you know. But as far as the, you know, the actual business operations, yeah, it's myself and my brother and my dad. We're the three guys, you know, basically grinding out, making things happen. That's one thing that he, you know, my dad really instilled in us when we started is, you know, once you take that step and hire on workforce, you know, it's not just an employee, you know, things can snowball in a hurry. And they can get out of hand, you know, in a hurry if you're not careful. So we're trying to stay as small as we can for as long as we can, you know, while we're still able to, you know, keep it manageable. Because he got to a point where he got too big. He took on too much, hired too many people, and it was just not enjoyable for him. That was one of the, you know, he loves logging. You know, everything that was involved with it. And so he's harped and preached, you know, if you can afford to not hire employees, if you can, you know, it's easy to blow things out of proportion and you start, you know, being successful and you're making money. It's really easy to you know, grow and then things get out of hand. And he's just, you know, made it very clear that you have to be careful. You know, keeping overhead small. You know, we're small, so we're agile, right? Mm-hmm. We're not super cumbersome. We don't have a huge overhead. If we needed to, you know, that's one of the beauties about if we needed to take off for, you know, last week, you know, 3 or 4 days to go racing, you know, we can do that. I don't have to, you know, keep revenue moving to keep the lights on. We don't, you know, we own the shop. We own all the equipment. So it's a blessing and a curse because the unfortunate side of that is all of the employees of TNC Concepts are also all of the employees of Starks Racing. So if we go racing, that means TNC is shut down and running. Don't really go racing, right? So, but we're in a position to where we can kind of pick and choose what we need to do. If we can afford to, you know, keep, you know, shut down work for a couple of days and go race, then that's great. So we're in a pretty good spot. It is definitely a lot of work for the employees that are involved, but it pays off because we get to, you know, do the things that we enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But we're as long as our customers are happy and they understand that, you know, hey, we're out for a couple of days, but we'll be back next week, then everything seems to work out just fine.
Speaking of going racing, you guys went racing this past weekend, a little bit of a drive, put some miles on the trailer, went down to Trophy Cup, and boy, that was my first experience at Trophy Cup, and I think one word sums up Trophy Cup to me, and it's chaotic.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up racing Trophy Cup our first couple of years. I think we raced from 2010 to 2013 or 14. We were down there every year. And it's a race that had just, you know, beaten me down. I mean, I still haven't figured out a way to beat it. years we went there, I've been a lot happier with, you know, our speed there and how we performed. But when I went there in 2010, I think I finished seventh on our, this was back when it was just a two-night show. I finished seventh on our prelim night, and we made the feature. And this was at the time where, you know, two-day show, the entries were capped at 80. I mean, it was cutthroat. Not that it isn't now, but it was like, it was very overwhelming for a 14-year-old kid. I kind of put myself in Levi Hillier's shoes, and he's done even a better job than I did back then. And I remember how, you know, overwhelming just the entirety of that race was. So it seemed like in 2010, that was our best year. We, like I said, I finished seventh, kind of got out of there unscathed, made the feature, had a decent showing. And then every year it's like it got worse. We, you know, tore up more and more equipment and, you know, weren't as good. And so it was a race that just kind of discouraged me there for a while. So between that and then getting the opportunities back east, you know, I didn't run Trophy Cup, but I ran for Shannon Wheatley, I think, in 2017. And I think we got crashed in the beam in or something. Didn't have a very good showing. But since then, you know, then the next time I ran it was for Kevin last year. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a breath of fresh air, I guess, getting back to that race and actually having a good showing and having speed. And so that kind of, you know, got me going about Trophy Cup again. It was, and I loved the race. I just couldn't figure out how to race it. You know what I mean? We weren't ever that great there. So, you know, to get back there last year and have a good showing with Kevin, and then to go there with our stuff this year, not that we didn't have, you know, our hiccups this year, I think, I mean, honestly, it sounds bad, but getting out of Trophy Cup with, you know, only one car and a couple top wings damaged is honestly not bad. And it sounds bad, but that's how Trophy Cup is. I mean, you are racing not only as hard as you can against the other cars, but it's one of the only tracks that, I mean, Caleri fights back harder than any track out there. It, you know, you cannot take a lap off, and if you do, you know, one misstep, it'll bite you. The only place in format where, I mean, I say it a lot, but you absolutely every single lap, or else, you know, if you're not, either the cars or the other cars are going to go by it, or the track's going to get you. So, yeah, it's a tough race, but it's really cool to see what it's developed into now that Kevin and 26 Promotions have taken it over, and to see what they're doing with it and the plans for the years coming. I'm excited that we were able to be a part of it with our 55 again this year, first time in about 10 years, I think. I'm excited about what it's going to build back in.
I'm curious to know, in your early years, you referenced running Trophy Cup, you couldn't figure it out. Was it a combination of getting the proper setup, or was it just how tricky that track is to run, and how kind of cowboy up I feel like you have to be to run it?
I think it's just being a younger kid and being aggressive. You at Trophy Cup, you have to be aggressive in all the right ways. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like a young kid being on the gas, you know, I think of a lot as a kid that's not afraid to, you know, run above the cushion. Mm-hmm. Well, for example, at Trophy Cup, you can't really run above the cushion. Above the cushion is the wall. So it takes a kind of a finesse along with a aggressive driving style at the same time. And I just don't think I had that back then. I think I maybe had one or the other. So I either ran the cushion too hard or not hard enough, or I just didn't. I think we had some false confidence after having a really good first year down there. And we just, I don't think I was really ready for it. Not ready to go down there. I mean, unfortunately, you have to put the laps in and put the time in, and you get your butt kicked by the track and the other cars. That just, it is a guaranteed prerequisite in sprint car racing, no matter where you go, is you can't just show up and kick butt. You got to get your butt kicked. So I think that was part of it. We just learning as a younger kid at a track that's really tough against really tough competition, which I think emphasizes just how talented a kid like Levi Hillier is, because just as in his second year down there, I mean, he looked like a veteran there, you know, for on not only on Friday or on Saturday night, but also on his prelim night. So, and I know how tough it is to go down there and do that, especially when you don't run the track all year and you've only seen it twice. You know, we don't run there very often, but I've been seeing track since 2010. So, I think that's a big factor in it too. I'll preach it over and over that there's no replacement for seat time and laps around a racetrack if you're looking to, you know, get better in sprint car racing or any type of racing.
What was the transition like from you going from a micro to getting into a 410 sprint car at 14 years old?
I mean, it was huge, and it wasn't always the plan. You know, we were looking for a new race hauler, because we were making many trips down. We ran Deming a lot, but mm-hmm. we were also making trips down to run, you know, Lemoore and Plaza Park and Delta, I think, a few tracks, because the competition at Deming was great. But my dad has kind of instilled, and my grandpa, from the beginning, that if you run one place all the time, you know, you'll get stuck in a rut. You might get really good there, but in order to be well-rounded, you got to travel, go race different tracks, go race against different competitions. So we weren't necessarily interested in you know, running Deming every single weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But we were traveling more, so we needed a bigger race rig. And the one that we found it in Montana, and it just so happened to come with a complete sprint car operation.
Wow.
Truck, trailer, three cars, three engines, a mule, everything to go racing. And so it was one of those things where we didn't plan on it, but we kind of felt that we planned on kind of one more year in micros, and then mm-hmm. what happened. And it was really waiting till I was, you know, my grandpa raced pavement and dirt midgets. My dad raced asphalt and dirt midgets, sprint cars, silver crown cars there towards the end of the year. He ran a lot of USAC stuff. We just didn't have a huge background in wing sprint car racing. And so my path was always USAC. So at the time I was 13 or 14, and the plan was, well, until you're old enough to get in, you know, a midget at 16, because that was the rule for USAC or WMRA or anything. You know, we'll wait till you're 16, and then, you know, we'll be ready. And in the meantime, we'll have, you know, the hauler to make everything happen. And we didn't really have a plan. We thought maybe we'll sell. You know, it's a really good deal for the truck and trailer, let alone all the other stuff that come with it. So, worst case scenario, you know, we sell the contents. And once we kind of got everything out and kind of, you know, spread out and started going through everything, I think we just kind of got excited about, you know, moving up to that next level. And lo and behold, at 14 years old, I could go run a winged 410 or a 360. And it's like, well, if it's just opportunity presenting itself and we have all the stuff, why not? And so we went down to Sills and at Marysville and made laps there. And he said, you know, everything, you look good, you look under control. So he kind of made some phone calls and put in, you know, advocated for on behalf of me as a 14-year-old to go race. Looking back now, I will 100% say that I was too young. I think an age that is, you know, too young, I think you need experience, but that's how it went. We had all the stuff to go do it. So we had every, you know, just as much right to be out there as anybody else. We went sprint car racing. It was a big change, especially, like I said, at a young age. But it was another one of those situations where it was, you know, trial by fire. Good luck. Your first race is a 410 race at Skagit, you know? That put my feet to the fire real quick. I was able to learn really quickly. Again, don't think I would really be where we're at today if I wasn't able to start so early. It's a big, big, big transition. I definitely don't think that was the most orthodox way to go about it. But it got me to where we are today. So I'm thankful that we were able to, get that opportunity and go race and put those laps in.
Was there ever a route where you would have went pavement like your dad and grandpa, or were you always kind of on the dirt track?
No, I mean, it was always the plan, since as long as I can remember.
Okay.
Really intelligent that we picked up that rig and, you know, we realized that, hey, we have the equipment and I'm old enough to go race and, you know, it, we can do it. But up until that moment, it was always, you know, it wasn't necessarily something that we talked about all the time, but it was just kind of understood, you know, this is kind of the direction you go. A lot of quarter midgets, you know, there, a lot of kids race quarter midgets around here, and uh-huh. then there's multiple avenues you can go to. Well, something that there was a lot of people doing around here, I think of names that you may or may not be familiar with, but ironically, Dallas Melby, mm-hmm. Brianna Lopez, Logan Forler, mm-hmm. The kids that we race quarter midgets with, the path was race quarter midgets until you're 12 or 13, go race micros for a couple years, and then go straight to midgets and start running WMRA. Hmm. Like guys like Evan Margeson, a bunch of them. And we raced quarter midgets till I was 9. I got in quarter midgets, or I got in micros when I was 9. A fake birth certificate or two later, and I was in open 600 by the time I was like 11. And so we had a couple years in micros already by the time I was 14. And at that point, it was, you know, after transitioning that quick, it's like, well, we've been, you know, racing micros forever, so it's time to do something else. Hmm. But no, the plan was always to, you know, go non-wing, USAC, asphalt, dirt, that direction. And, you know, when wing sprint car racing got a hold of me, and it hasn't let go yet.
At that point, even when you got into the sprint cars at 14, was there ever a moment in time where you kind of thought, okay, when we turn 16, maybe we'll flip back to the pavement side of things? Or was that kind of a bygone thought after?
There was. No, there really was. Unfortunately, the main midget series up here, WMRA, was kind of, you know, dwindling.
Okay.
And we were so busy with, you could race so much more with a wing sprint car, or, you know, 360 or 410, than anything else. So mm-hmm. at that point, it was like, we're so invested now, like we're racing, you know, 60 times a year. You can't even think of racing that much, without traveling. But we could race 30, 40, 50 times a year, between, you know, the ASCS Northwest and then King of the West, mm-hmm. which was California at the time, which was what NARC is. You could race as much as you want. So at that point, it was like, well, we could, but why? We can race more for more money. You know, it's thriving. We have all the stuff to do it. You know, guys know now, midgets are, you know, they're not as expensive as wing sprint cars, but they're not far off. So to have every different kind of car didn't seem practical. By the time I turned 16, I was already my second or third year of racing. So it's like, we were so busy with it that it's, you know, it's something we thought about, but it wasn't necessarily practical.
Okay. That makes sense. What do you see your bucket list being for the rest of your racing career? Anything that you haven't done, races you haven't raced in that you want to, or places you still want to try out?
That's a great question. You know, I've been pretty fortunate to race, you know, all over the country. You know, we've the big ones, we pretty much hit all of them. We've raced at Eldora, we've raced Knoxville, we've raced in Pennsylvania, we've raced pretty much anywhere in California you can get to. I've ran the Chili Bowl. I don't have a whole lot back on my, besides Eldora, we really never raced a whole lot in Ohio. So, like, I don't have a ton of experience at places like Attica or Fremont or things like, you know, places mm-hmm. like that, that I would like to maybe at some point, you know, race on a little bit more. But no, we've been very fortunate to, you know, kind of hit all of them. And that was, again, going back to the traveling down to California and micros. When we traveled with the 55 in, you know, 2012 and 2013, that was the idea, to kind of get exposed to as many different tracks and as many different levels of competition and different drivers and all that. So, you know, we took the 55 back to Pennsylvania and ran through, you know, Ohio and ran Eldora, ran through to Dakotas on the way there and back. You know, I've been very fortunate to see a lot. You know, at some point I've always said, you know, I just, because there's so much background in our family with USAC and especially like asphalt midgets, back when the copper world was big, I mean, my dad ran Silver Crown in sprint cars. I think they ran, he said the toughest thing he ever did was running a non-wing pavement 410 sprint car at Richmond. And so I think, you know, getting something back on asphalt, maybe one day, if it's just, you know, a one-time thing, a cameo or, you know, anything. I know there's, there's the show that Davey Hamilton promotes.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that might be cool. I know there's a lot of pretty good winged pavement sprint car racing around here. Like I know they run at Monroe and up in Canada a lot. So maybe one day something like that. But I'm pretty satisfied with everything we've gotten to go do and where I've been able to travel. There's another one. We've been to Australia twice. So I'm pretty content with what, like I said, very thankful and content with what I've been able to see and go do and places I've got to race at. My bucket pretty much full as far as that is concerned.
I wanted to ask because you said it, you've been so many places, if there was anything that was left on that bucket list. But Trey, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
this has been a really fun 54 minutes. I feel like we could keep talking, but I know we'll let you get back to work, and your dad and Colin can't yell at you for slacking off and chatting with us on the phone all day.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been great. I'm glad to be able to talk to you guys again. I look forward to listening to these every week. So, it's cool to be a little piece of it. It's rewarding for me to be able to dive back in to things over the years and kind of get, you know, into the weeds about things. So, thanks for having me on, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, we'll see you later, Trey. So, take care, Trey. Thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
Yep, bye.
Welcome back, everyone. A good chat there with Trey Starson. He's a guy that's kind of done a little bit of everything, as you heard. Whether it was racing in Pennsylvania, California, and everywhere in between, Trey's had a great career, and a lot of that, lucky enough for us, is cemented right here at Skagit Speedway, where he had an incredible season this year. But we did hit on a little bit of Trophy Cup, which is what we wanted to do, and Trophy Cup was a phenomenal event. Abreu Vineyards Trophy Cup 31, benefiting the Racer Dean Foundation, powered by 26 Promotions. Joel Myers Jr. picked up the win in what was probably the biggest win of his career, $30,000 payday. He won the points championship. Tanner Holmes won the $10,000 to win race. So that's the unique thing about Trophy Cup. It's a race within a race. You've got guys racing for the $10,000 to win A main, and then you've got guys racing from the back that are chasing the points championship, and it's a full invert. We invert every car. So the B main winner doesn't start in the back. They start up front in a great spot to win 10 grand. So it was fun. It was the most chaotic racing I've ever seen in my life, without a doubt. My voice was struggling as it's just out of shape, not announcing anymore. And then you try to go down there and announce that race, and it's, whoa. I had told my mom and dad that's like running a marathon without doing any training. That was kind of what I put my vocal cords through last week, but it was fun. I can't wait for next year.
Did it live up to everything? I mean,
100%.
Talking to you in the office, it lived up to every expectation that you... Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It was, I can't wait for next year. I can't wait to see what we can do with this event. And really now we can kind of put both feet forward planning the event for next year. So I think this is an event you're only going to see grow in the coming years, especially being partnered with Flow Racing. I think we're going to see attendance on the rise as the world got to see how chaotic that race is and how fun it is with the big inverts. It's a lot of kind of what we see here, Eric, during Dirt Cup. Not quite,
but
this
similar,
big
yeah.
Inverted Dirt Cup, but very, very big invert. Obviously, Dirt Cup were inverting 16, 18 cars there. We're going 20 and 24 on the last night because there's more than just winning the race. And ultimately, that's kind of the goal of Trophy Cup. But no, it was fun, and I'm excited to see how we can build that race in the years to come and continue to kind of work with everybody to get the car count back to where we want it to be. Obviously, we had a solid car count. We were right around 60. That's great. I mean, that's really good. We'll take that anywhere, but I think next year we can push that higher.
Was there one takeaway from the event for you that you didn't expect but was a very pleasant surprise? You're like, oh, I didn't... No one had told me about that, but it was...
Nothing really stuck out. Okay. I think the event itself, I mean, every night they've got a feed, which was great. Yeah. We could go down and get food and, you know, free will donation there, and that was full. It was nice to see kind of put everyone in one spot after the races, and everyone had drinks, and we went for the first night and just kind of dropped in and ate real quick, had tacos, and went back to the hotel to go to bed because first night was a long night. Night two, we fed. I mean, that was by the time I got there, served up a little bit of food, but I was talking with Kevin Rudine quite a bit as we were kind of running everything down and kind of slowing down from the announcing side of things there and finishing up my duties there. By the time we got there, they were already pretty well into the barbecue feed. That was really good. And night two, they had a nacho feed. I think Lisa went down to that, but we had an early flight on on Sunday morning. We had to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get to the airport. So it was kind of like, okay, let's go get 3-4 hours of sleep. But the event itself, if you're on the fence of going, or even, you know, just even tossing it around, like, do it. Just pull the trigger and go. It's worth it. It's nonstop entertainment all the time. There's always something happening, whether we've got the raffles going or the racing during the day. But it's just, it's a really enjoyable event, and it's nice to get down there and into a 75-degree weather, too.
Well, you even had a fun event that Wednesday before, horseshoes, mini golf, right?
At the, and the mini golf course was really cool. John put that together, and that was really neat.
How many holes was it?
It was, I think, 7 or 8.
Okay.
But I bet I played Levi Hillier at least once in it. And I think Savannah Hillier and I, Levi's little sister, Savannah and I played probably 4 or 5 rounds.
Did you win? Or did you keep score? Or
was yeah. She wanted to beat me. She didn't beat me. Oh. I wouldn't let her beat me. Are you kidding me? I wouldn't hear the end of that if I
did
let
Levi
Savannah
beat you?
Me. No.
Okay.
I don't think Levi. No. I mean, Levi and I were close. Levi. Okay. But Savannah's good. I did not let her keep. She kept it close. Savannah's good. After a couple holes, say, oh, I got to buckle up here because Savannah can go. And it was tough. That little course was tough that John put together. So it was really neat. But it was a neat event, and it's something kind of like you've seen us do here, Eric. You know, at our events, our races, we're trying to turn them into events. And that's easier said than done. But I think we're heading in the right direction everywhere, down there and up here. And, I had a pre-race show Saturday, talked to a lot of drivers about that. And then at the end, talked to the Katings and had Kevin on and kind of talked about NARC just for a minute and what the plans are there, and kind of killed anyone thinking that NARC's not going to be around next year. Kev said, absolutely not. We're going to have a schedule. So we'll work on that. And I think it's going to be a fun off season here. And obviously we've on the national scene start to see some of those dominoes fall. So it's the next couple of weeks are going to be big.
Do you want to get into some of that national scene at all?
I mean obviously the big news this week, Spencer Baisden going to hop in the Stenhouse Junior Marshall ride in the 17, so that's good. Kyle Pruitt will be the crew chief. And I saw, boy, they had Nate Repitz on the wrenches this weekend, and I'm blanking who else. They had another good name. They had a solid crew, and Sheldon won this week in that car. So Sheldon's still going. I think, where did he win? He won Angel Park?
Oh, on a Sunday race. Yeah,
that
I know
was Angel Park because they rained out Saturday at LaSalle. So neat to see Sheldon win and show that crew can do it. And obviously Spencer going to be in that car next year, and they're going to be full-time with the World of Outlaws. I know Cole Schroeder, the 3 car, he mentioned to me in the driver interviews on Saturday that their plan is to go run Volusia in February with the Outlaws and kind of work their way back, and High Limit will pick up then and then run through the West Coast with High Limit and then run the full NARC schedule in 2026. So that's exciting. A driver bumping up there. But things are starting to kind of shake loose here.
Brad Sweet retired, obviously, that was announced on Sunday. And
there's a lot of rumors on what's going to happen there. It sounds like Dason Pursley probably going to be the replacement driver there, which...
That'll be a fun pairing to
watch. That'll be a fun pairing. And it sounds like maybe Jarrett Martin, the crew chief. Jarrett spent a lot of time with Keith Coons Motorsports and was a very successful midget crew chief and joined KKR right after the national shakeup that they had where they let everybody go. Yeah. So that was interesting there. And Tom Book, I talk with Tom every day, and he's, or not every day, but I'd say 4 out of the 5 days of the week during the weekdays, Tom and I are texting, and he's got some eyes on some younger drivers. I imagine you'll see a younger driver that probably hasn't run a national tour in that car. Tom kind of gets a kick out of that, and I think he had a lot of success.
One that person's leaving?
Yep, the 13 car. I think, obviously, Tom was very good with Dason there, and really Justin Peck before that had a lot of success with Justin. Yeah. And Justin had a handful of all-star wins before he went out on the road with Tom, but never had run a national tour before from start to finish. He had run about half a season with the all-stars with us in Pete Grove's 70 car, if I'm not mistaken. That whole time frame back then gets a little murky for me because Pete had a lot of drivers in and out of his cars. He got a he got a lot of young drivers, a lot of experience at a young age in that Baby Blue 70, which was cool. But no, there's going to be some news and some shakeup coming in the next couple of weeks, Eric, which is going to be fun. And
I'm
then
excited.
Obviously it's going to be kind of like the late model world of, does anyone switch tours? Who's following what? What teams do any outlaw teams jump over, vice versa?
Do you think we'll see a lot of that?
I think we'll see a team or two flip.
Okay.
Not a ton, but I think we'll see a team or two flip. I mean, High Limit has a great package, and the Outlaws also have a great package over there for their teams. I mean, it's maybe not quite as lucrative as the franchise system that High Limit has rolled out, but if you think the Outlaws aren't going to have an answer, or something, that you're pretty foolish, in my opinion. I think that World Racing Group will roll out a good package for 2026 that'll be competitive. So, and we're starting to see some races get announced. Knoxville already announced. Knoxville and Huset's added a race on Memorial Day weekend, so that's a little shakeup in that schedule because last year the Outlaws were in Ohio, which enabled then High Limit had a Sunday race at Port Royal, the Bob Weikert Memorial that paid $100,000. The Outlaws were off on Sunday, so you saw some outlaw teams drive this 6 hours down the road to Port Royal, and you let the rumors swirl there. Is that the Outlaws saying, screw you, no, you're not going to be able to do that? No, I don't think it is. I think some people will buy into that, but I don't believe that's the case. I think they had a good opportunity to go run at Knoxville and Huset's, and both those races are going to pay $20,000 at two staple tracks for the Outlaws and Dirt Vision. I mean, two anchor tracks for them. So obviously there's going to be a little bit more loyalty to those tracks, and that's just good business in my opinion. So it'll be interesting to see back home though, how that people respond. Cause now at Knoxville, you've got the Outlaws the third week of April. You've got the Outlaws the third week of March. You've got the Outlaws the second week of June. And then you've got them coming back for Nationals. And is that maybe overkill? I don't know. I mean, that's, I guess, what Knoxville will find out. And they've got a great program going at Knoxville. I mean, they've got probably the strongest weekly program in the country. Yeah. And obviously you have the Super Bowl of our sport, or maybe the Super Bowl is the Knoxville Nationals of football. I don't know. But yeah, my favorite race of the year. I always look forward to getting home, and Knoxville's a special place. So that'll be neat to see another premier race at the Sprint Car Capital of the world. Yeah. And Huset's continues to grow. And I saw Doug Johnson on a podcast last night announced that the Silver Dollar Nationals, the big late model race that they have at Huset's, that's $53,000 to win, won't be returning next year. And the rumors are that's going to shift down to east or western Iowa to Harlan, which is maybe an hour from where the Silver Dollar Nationals originated at I-80 Speedway. But so that's kind of a shift in the late model schedule as well. And we saw that another shift in the late model schedule, the Dirt Track World Championship, where Lucas Oil late models ends their season, shifting to West Virginia Motor Speedway. Which, I mean, that's kind of probably where that race belongs, in that Ohio Valley down there. But then Eldora also announcing the second weekend, because I think it's the 8th and 9th next year, off the top of my head, they're going to have a two-day Lucas Oil late model show there that'll pay $50,000 to win. So not losing dates there, but Devin Moran picked up the Lucas Oil title, and the Moran family, they own Muskingum County Speedway, where we ran quite a bit with the All-Stars through the years. They run some sprint car shows there. But we're really going to see, I think, some of this stuff, Eric, in the next couple of weeks shake up. Obviously, you get to World Finals in a couple of weeks. Yeah. And I saw we have 18 410 sprint car races left in the United States this year. But that's kind of depressing.
That is kind of depressing.
You look and
it rolls into more racing after
that. It does. And I was on the phone with my mom and dad last night kind of talking about things. And I'm like, man, November is chaotic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we slow down, but then you've got WARPA, Thanksgiving, and then I get into December, and it's the Dome the first weekend, then I'll fly home the week after that for Tyler Courtney's wedding, and then it's the holidays, then it's Tulsa Shootout back here for a week, Chili Bowl, and then we're, a couple of weeks away from kicking the World of Outlaws schedule off at Volusia, which is always fun to watch, and you'll be able to watch some racing here in the office during the day as we're racing in Tulsa, because of this time zone. And then
the one time I don't hate this time zone. I like waking up and watching.
I won't go on that rant again. But that time of year, I mean, I know last year Lisa watched quite a bit because I'd hear she'd text Eric and I during the day early morning.
Caleb, it's like,
because we're both announcing it.
Yeah. You said Eric and Caleb.
Oh, geez, Caleb, sorry. Yeah. And she'd text us and what's happening, and it probably makes the day go by a little bit faster. And then last year we'd have the Dirt Vision stuff on during the day because they start at like noon our time. So.
Yeah,
I'll have to get with Brian Dunlap, make sure we're good there. But it'll be here before we know it, and we'll be racing at Skagit. I imagine sometime in the next, I'd hope in the next 2 months, we'll have our schedule out for next year. So that'll be fun, too. We'll be selling tickets before we know it.
Yeah. But stay tuned to all the Skagit Speedway social medias, Facebook, yeah. Instagram, Twitter, now X, TikTok, Snapchat, YouTube.
Yeah, we're hammering it.
It's constant.
There's going to be content coming at
yes,
you.
Yes, content. There we go.
Every day. I mean, you've got me, I don't know, what, 100 shorts and reels and TikToks like to post?
I'm going
to
get you more, too.
So that's all right. We like that.
We'll keep get more coming. Racing reels. We've got some fun
and
old
we have,
videos.
You want to talk about it? Let's talk about it. Oh, a month ago, I'd say what? More than that, because I guess our season ended a month ago. Probably 6 weeks ago.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We inherited about 200 VHS tapes.
Yeah.
I'd say, about, I don't know, yeah, 100 to 100 to
yeah,
200.
Yeah, I'd say
200 is a lot of them.
An accurate there's, number.
There's a lot of them. I went through them all yesterday and got them all sorted, but. So with that being said, Eric and I's little project for the winter is we got a digitizer and we're going to set up a VHS or a VCR, which if you've seen a VCR before, this is not... Okay.
Well, so I mean, VHS tapes were around until like 2008-ish. So I was born right as they were ending.
Okay.
But I remember my grandma, I think, still has them. I watched movies. So I remember them vaguely until 2008, 2010, and then, you know, DVDs.
That
so.
Wasn't me being a jerk. That was an honest question because I wasn't sure kind of when they phased out for you.
Yeah, they were right
there.
In my early years, yeah.
Nonetheless, we're going to set up a VHS play or a VCR, pop the VHS in. Yep. We've got a digitizer to record it. So we'll get that on a flash drive, get it to you, and make sure that, you know, hey, it's what we think it is, first off, because we don't want to post something that we don't think it is. And we'll go through it and give stuff a watch and edit out the fluff. And we'll have a lot of racing from the 80s and 90s posted on our YouTube channel this winter. So if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel, please subscribe. We appreciate that. But I looked and we've got a lot of 1986, a lot of 87. We have to have.
And this is weekly shows, too.
Weekly shows, yeah. A lot of the 86, 87 weekly shows. And I'd be surprised if we're missing a weekly show, or more than one or two weekly shows in 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, jeez, and into 93. We've got a lot of the Dirt Cups. And I was talking with Dean Mills yesterday, who should be in the Hall of Fame, legendary videographer, stills at it. And Dean's got a good majority of our Dirt Cups. And what we don't have, he's going to get our way. And then, so if you got VHS tapes that don't fall in that range, or you're listening and you want to know if we've got it, and we can borrow it just to digitize it for, you know, a day or two, if you've got a bunch of them, please let us know. Reach out to us. I know that Blumenhagen's have some too, because Roy gave me some last year to watch. Well, now we'll get those digitized. But
What's that time gap again that we're not looking for, or that we have a lot? Just
I'd say 88 to 92, 93 were probably pretty solid.
Yeah, anything that you have that's those years.
Yeah, anything outside of that realm, please, if you've got it and would let us borrow it for, you know, a week to get it digitized and get that file in our records, we would greatly appreciate it. So just shoot us a message on social media.
Yeah.
Any of the Skagit social media channels, Eric and I see them all. So if you shoot us
or
a message,
give the office a call.
Or give the office a call or email us info@skagitspeedway.com. Shoot us an email. But we would love that. That'd be great. And you don't have to bring them up tomorrow. Don't worry about that. But just, you know, maybe next race season, drop one off or something like that, or a little before. Because I would say we've probably got 200 hours of tapes to digitize. So you figure if we even go at it 40 hours a week, that's 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And we won't be at it for 40 hours a week. So. No. I would say if we could get through half of them this winter,
that'll be a good goal.
That would be good. But so that's something for you race fans to look forward to, is we're going to have a lot of old racing. Like I was telling you, a lot of that racing maybe hasn't seen the light of day
since it was filmed. Yeah.
And a lot of them are masters, which is good, which should help us, the master tapes. So
that's what you mean.
Higher quality.
Yeah.
And I'm excited.
That was before my time.
I'm excited because the one of the tapes we have in there is the one tape I've heard about since I started coming to Dirt Cup in 2022. That I wanted to see, because I'm hoping the interview's in it. We have the 1992 Dirt Cup that Bobby Burrows won, which was the first Skagit local to win Dirt Cup. Obviously, we had it again this year. He was the first Skagit local to win Dirt Cup, and I guess the place just went bananas. Nuts. So okay. I'm excited. I think we've got a tape. Yeah, fingers crossed. We've got a tape from 79.
Oh.
I don't know if it's pictures or video, though.
Yeah, you said that, yeah.
It might be pictures, but we'll still post that because Wolfgang won that year.
Yep.
And I'm guessing
he won
78 and 79. Yeah. So I'm this is just a loose guess here, but that time frame falls right about him being in the Speedway Motors 4X. I'm right in there.
Right.
Speedway Motors car or the Trostle car, which I'm guessing it's Speedway Motors because they traveled more when he ran Speedway Motors. But we've got a copy of the 82 Dirt Cup I saw. And then we've got 86 to 93.
Yeah.
So if you've got any Dirt Cups outside of that or anything, Outlaw races, we'd love to see
races.
Them. Ross Weiss from the Outlaws sent me some Skagit footage from 82.
Oh, yeah. Were you watching that?
Last week.
Okay.
That I had shown you there. I talked to Steve. I saw 21. I'm like, that looks like Beitler. So I texted Steve. Steve said that was his first year in a sprint car. And it was not a ton of racing footage. It's more so like motor heat, hot laps. And then we did see a little bit of racing, but there wasn't a whole – not announcing on it. Chet Corey, I know, was involved in a lot of those tapes with interviews. So that'll be good.
Yeah.
That'll be good. Chet's a legend. And we had five tapes that were just titled Woo. So I'm interested to pop those in and
I'm
see
excited for that.
If we can figure out what year those Outlaw tapes derive from.
Okay. That's going to be fun. I'm excited for this
because there was a large gap where the Outlaws didn't come here as well. So I'm excited to see, you know, if we can see some of those classic cars, those iconic cars that I don't know as many of the West Coast iconic cars. I mean, unless they're super, super iconic.
Yeah.
But the Midwest car owners and the Outlaw car owners back through the years, I know pretty well.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to kind of go through those tapes with you and see what
I'm
we can find.
It's going to be fun.
I text JY and I know one of the tapes from 86 was because the people that – I guess I can give the quick story on how we acquired them.
Yeah.
So they were – back in the early 2000s, Beitler had all these tapes. And a company in Seattle was going to do a Skagit Speedway documentary or something or history of Skagit Speedway. Business partners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they got all the tapes. Business partners split. Tapes got put in storage. Forgot about. Last year, we got an email from one of the business partners. Hey, I just went through my storage and I have like all these tapes. Would you guys like them back? We said yes, and a year went by.
Yeah,
I'd completely forgotten about it, and it was I want to say it was maybe High Limit race weekend. He dropped all these boxes off, and it was all these tapes. And I was like, "What are we gonna do with these? Like, these are great to have, but what are we gonna do?" And then you and I got to talking to Ross Weiss last week. Ross works for the Outlaws; they're a great video guy. And Ross said, "Yeah." And it came across that's when he sent the video from 82, and he said, "Yeah, we're getting all these." These old beta tapes digitized. We're going to send them to Atlanta and get them digitized. It's going to cost a lot of money, but that's a lot of Outlaw history. And all I could think is, I don't think I could get John to bite on spending $5,000 to get these tapes digitized. You and I went to work in the office and found we can get a VHS to digital file converter for like $150. Yeah. Where to get the beta stuff done, and we do have some beta tapes in there.
Do we?
To get those done, that costs a little bit more money, and I don't know. I'll get with John
what
eventually.
What plays a beta
see.
Tape? Is it? It I wasn't
even,
a beta.
That was before my time. Betas in the early 80s.
Okay.
But we had several reels in there. So, I mean, I'll see. You know, once we get them all done, I'll see if I can talk John into letting us get those done at some point. We'll have to send them off somewhere, though. But you and I went to John, and I thought, I don't know if John's going to bite on it. He might not. He was like, yeah, absolutely. Do it.
It's good for the history.
Yeah. So we'll have all that. And that'll be fun because we'll pop off some TikToks and reels of some racing from the 80s and early 90s.
It's going to be fun.
Especially Dirt Cup time. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited. Dirt Cup. Dirt Cup Outlaws.
I kind of got them. I went through and in our storage room, got them sorted by year. So they're in order from year to year. Yeah. One of the tapes I'm excited to watch, Skagit Speedway raced on the day I was born.
Oh, did they?
So the day I was born, we have that July 29th, 1989, Skagit Speedway raced. It was a Saturday, and we raced that day. So I'm excited to pop that one in eventually and see. But no, I will figure out a way. But I've got them all sorted by – I pulled all the Dirt Cups out, so separated the Dirt Cups. But we've got all the weekly shows sorted in chronological date so we can kind of pull however we want. If we want to start oldest to and work our way forward, we can, whatever. You and I can decide that. But we've got all the Dirt Cups. And then we've got maybe 20 to 30 just random tapes that are just like thrills and spills, Skagit Speedway history, year in review, unmarked.
Okay.
I have no idea what some of them are.
We'll find out.
So we'll find out. But yeah, stay tuned.
It's going to be a fun off season.
It's going to be a fun off season, that's for sure. And that's probably going to be an off season project regardless of you know, we'll get what we can get done this year, and then once we get racing,
it'll be an off season.
Exactly, yeah. Kind of like getting, you know, I'm getting all our history documented, all our old historical results, and it's kind of once we get racing, it's hard to you know, with so much going on, it's a little bit more difficult to do that. But I'd like to. Another thing, if you have old copies of Racing Wheels magazine, I think it was called Racing Wheels magazine, I'm looking for any results at Skagit Speedway previous to 1993 or previous to 94. So I think I'm pretty set 94 to now. I just got to get it on the website, which I'm working on. I'm working on 2004 right now. But if I'm looking for results from the 1993 season and older and before.
Yeah.
So if you've got any results in there, please, if you make a copy of it, take a picture of the results, drop the copies off, we'll get them, we'll return them, no problem at all. Like, you're not, don't feel like you have to donate them. No, we're not asking that. We don't want to keep them. We'll get them back to you, but I'm just trying to get as much history and wins documented as I can across everything. I think Modifieds 2011 and before, Hornets 2011 and before, I'm missing a lot of that, but I've got the sprint car results, so there we go. That's what we got for you this week. We'll see what we got for next week. We'll probably, hopefully, have a couple of these races digitized. We don't know if we'll have them online, but we'll be able to talk about that next week, hopefully.
I didn't think about that. Yes, we will, because it comes in Thursday.
Supposed to get them, supposed to get the digitizer tomorrow.
Yeah. Do you have a, we'll get a, well,
I'll,
we can talk.
I'll bring the VCR up tomorrow. Okay. So, yep. Yeah. You're good there. So, perfect. I'll unplug all that tonight, and I'll bring it tomorrow so we can get it plugged in, set up here, and you and I can grab a couple of VHS tapes and... It's going to take a lot of time. A lot of those tapes are over an hour, but let it
set
run
it
for
walk away.
Set it, walk away, and come back up an hour later and unplug. We need to get a zip drive too.
Yeah.
Get the zip drive pulled out, and we'll plug it into your laptop, and
away we go.
Away we go. But with that being said, we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
We'll have more sprint car news for you, hopefully, I imagine.
Another fun guest for you, probably.
Another fun guest, and we'll be able to talk 1986 Skagit Speedway. Never know.
Rolling.
All right. Eric, what do you think?
That's phenomenal. Thanks, Blake, for joining. We appreciate Trey coming on, too. Thank you all for listening. Again, you can follow us on Skagit Speedway, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, YouTube. It's going to be fun. Until next time, we'll talk to you next week. Take care, everyone.